Live from the Great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Drop what
you're doing. On many occasions, I have said and written that when people find themselves in trouble, in danger, the last people they want to call are the police. Now, that's not because every police officer is deranged or corrupt. That's not true. I wouldn't even say that most are deranged and corrupt. It's because when police intervene, there's a certain modality of action for which they are trained, and there are certain protocols they will follow that usually have very little to do with the needs of the person who solicited their help. If you're dealing, for instance, with somebody who has a medical emergency, if you're dealing with somebody who has psychological problems, if you're confronting some kind of a circumstance in which you don't have a criminal threat to your person, then you really shouldn't be seeking the help of the police. On the other hand, if you're dealing with an armed, aggressive criminal, by the time the police get there, they'd be good for a little more than drawing the chalk outlines and stringing up the crime scene tapes. So what's the point of calling them then? I do know, and this is something I will reiterate, because of course it's de rigueur that I do so, I do know of many very good people who are law enforcement officers, sheriffs, sheriff's deputies, street police, police detectives. I know many people of that sort. I'm on good terms with the people here in the Payette Police Department for the most part. There are a couple I'm not particularly fond of. I've had issues with the local sheriff's department. I've had issues with sheriff's departments elsewhere in the state of Idaho, a subject about which I will not elaborate for the purposes of this discussion. But I do know and I appreciate those in law enforcement who are conscientious and who, on many occasions, do things that are genuinely service-oriented. When I have the chance to do so, I celebrate those examples. Unfortunately, a strong plurality, if not a majority of cases, involving contact between police officers and innocent non-police officers, I'm not going to call us civilians because I don't subscribe to the martial law mindset, turn out badly. Now, here's a really good example of that tendency. There's a fellow by the name of Michael Housley who lives in Arnold, Maryland. I'm not sure where Arnold, Maryland is. It seems to be near Annapolis. Almost exactly a year ago, a year ago on Monday, his wife, who apparently has emotional or psychological problems, decided to check herself out of the hospital. She had been taken into the hospital for a psychiatric evaluation. I don't know the circumstances. I don't know the problems they were having. She's in her early 40s. He's in his early 50s. They're apparently on pretty good terms. He took her home, and a nurse at the hospital called the police and asked them to intervene by doing a safety check on this woman. That's a bad thing, and as my friend Jerry Lynn Ward, who's a wonderful attorney in Texas, points out, that's a typical thing of our corporatist medical system in this country. We don't have a free market medical system. Even prior to Obamacare, we were living in a country blighted with a corporatist medical system, about which I will offer this a similar caveat. There are many people who are healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners. I know many people of that description who are wonderful caregivers. And most of them are furious most of the time about the way the system is run. One of the aspects of the system that is least agreeable is the fact that there is this interface between the corporatist medical system and law enforcement, including situations of this sort that don't involve any kind of criminal behavior. This nurse called the local police, asked them to run a safety check at the Housley home. Three officers showed up on the doorstep of the Housley home. Mr. Housley went out and said, "We don't want you here. My wife doesn't want you here. She's doing fine. She doesn't want to be at the hospital. I'll deal with her. I'm perfectly capable of handling her. Please leave." Unfortunately, the police did not do what they were required by law, by constitution, by common law principle to do, which is to bug off and leave him alone. They did not have exigent circumstances. They did not have probable cause. He was not a criminal suspect. He was on the threshold of his castle. they were armed strangers there by the invitation of a healthcare provider who was not privy to the facts. The woman in question was not under a court order. They had no right to be there. So naturally, one of them tried to detain Mr. Housley, which is to say, he physically assaulted him, and the worried husband shoved the aggressor aside and went back into the home, locked the door, and then dialed 911. What a charming and ingenuous gesture. He dialed 911. That's like seeking the help of Beelzebub to cast out Beelzebub, quite frankly. The police officer in charge at the scene called headquarters to ask for instructions. He got two contradictory directions. From one supervisor, he was told that it would be impermissible to force his way into the home for the reasons I just outlined. No exigent circumstances, no probable cause, nobody was wanted on a warrant, so they should have just turned around and left. Unfortunately, another supervisor said, oh, sure, you can force your way in. There's no reason why you can't. Well, you don't get any extra credit for guessing which of those instructions the police officers decided to follow. They broke down the door. Now, by this time, Mr. Housley and his wife were frantic because they're dealing now with an act of armed aggression by people who simply wouldn't leave. One of the officers doused Housley with pepper spray. Now, this, of course, is an incapacitating weapon. It's a form of assault. If you were to do that to a police officer at random, of course, you'd be charged with felonious assault. Now, Mr. Holmquist reacted to this by grabbing a chair. Now, a chair is not a deadly weapon. It is not a lethal weapon. You cannot kill somebody with a chair unless you really, really, really persist in striking him with it. Or the person on the receiving end of the chairs the blows you're inflicting with the chair is profoundly unlucky. There are circumstances in which it could be used as a lethal weapon. Usually it's just a way of telling somebody to get lost. Well, he picked up a chair, and so the officer who had been in charge of the scene pulled his gun and shot Housley. He shot him in his home. The man was unarmed. Oh, he was holding a chair. I guess that qualifies as a lethal weapon if you perceive this using these fear-tinted officer safety goggles that police officers always wear. He was shot in the neck. His wife, of course, was screaming in the background. Mr. Housley was in the hospital in intensive care for several days, and during that time he was kept under armed guard and his wife wasn't permitted to see him. Now, just a few weeks ago, Mr. Housley was acquitted of the most serious charges. Get a load of the charges that we're talking about here. He was charged with two counts of second-degree assault on a police officer, one count of resisting arrest, which, by the way, is not a crime in and of itself, and one count of reckless endangerment. He was acquitted of all those charges. He was found guilty of two counts of obstructing a police officer. Oh, in the middle of all this, and something I neglected to mention, was that in addition to being doused with pepper spray, he was also tasered twice. So apparently his obstruction consisted of absorbing two taser strikes and then getting in the way of a bullet fired by a police officer who had no right to be in the home. Now, the presiding judge fined Housley $500 for obstruction, and then he offered to have the other charges, or all these charges actually, expunged from his record after a brief term of probation. Now, to his considerable credit, Mr. Housley refused that deal. He had to pay the fine, unfortunately, but he refused the deal because he wants to challenge this conviction in court. And if he accepted the deal, of course, that would preempt any subsequent court challenge. But what this amounts to is that this man was fined $500 for obstructing the path of a police bullet that had been fired by somebody who had no right to be in his home in the context of a safety check. Now, that is a thread that I'm pulling on pretty consistently because I keep finding examples of people who are on the receiving end of police safety checks who end up being shot or tasered or otherwise injured or even killed by their supposed protectors in uniform. And even in such cases as that of Mr. Housley, where the person is not done to death by his uniform protectors, they often come to various serious bodily harm. In this case, of course, once again, he was prosecuted on a number of offenses, all of them dealing with the fact that the police would not leave his home when he ordered them off his property No, he, as the homeowner, as the property owner, as a law-abiding citizen, was their sovereign in this circumstance. I mean, that's settled Anglo-Saxon law going back into the tenebrous mists of English antiquity. Good grief. Alfred the Great and Ethelred the Unready were probably familiar with that principle. You know, all the way back to Horst and Hengist, for all I know, that principle is a matter of established law. You can actually find that in the book of Deuteronomy, for that matter. Anyhow, we'll be back in just a minute or two to talk about some other aspects of the government's full-spectrum assault on our liberties, and probably focus a little bit on the economic front of what's going on in terms of that assault. That's terrifying. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, so stick around for more subversion after this. System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
We are joined by Jeff from Chelsea, Massachusetts, who has been heroic in his patience. Jeff, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm right here. No, I was thinking about this. I'm listening to your a little bit of your prior segment and the segment right now, and I'm thinking, you know what? America in the future. We look at Obama and realize how bad and foul he is. What about the president after Obama? After Obama completely destroys the country. Now, what's this have to do with police? Everything, because you see, America's being set up for a Hitlerian dictator after Obama, who will completely strip away the local police officers that will make the police that assaulted this poor gentleman look like a saint. In other words, the police will say, we're here, we're going to be able to do whatever we want to do. And the president will say, we need to fight the war on Islam and the war on drugs. We'll put death squads on the street. We'll clean up the streets. We'll make the streets safe. And you know, the American people will go along with it. After Obama turns this country into a third world toilet, the American people would love to have an Adolf Hitler in power.
And as long as he's a nice, pious, homegrown, Midwestern-appearing guy like Buzz Winrip from It Can't Happen Here, the Sinclair Lewis premonitory novel of about 70 years ago that was actually, I think, inspired by Huey Long in Louisiana, but applies to so many situations here where we see the possibility for some kind of native and nativist regime in this country of the sort you're describing right now. You know, your scenario involving the war on drugs metastasizing into an outright third world banana republic type dictatorship was described to me by a fellow by the name of Michael Levine. He was a DEA undercover agent for decades, highly decorated. He had been in the military.
Yes.
If you've ever read any of the Tom Clancy novels, you know who Mr. Clark is, this enigmatic guy.
Oh, yes. His name
was John, can't remember his last name, but he's another Irish name. But he is basically Mr. Clark. If you see him, if you see pictures of him, if you talk with him, he's that guy. He's that capable, that dangerous of a guy. And he, at one point, back in the mid-1980s till about 1988, was working on an undercover sting called Operation Trifecta that would have decapitated the Mexican narcotics cartels, which were being run by the Mexican military then, as they are now.
Yes.
And they were going to lure the three or five, I can't remember which, top cartel officials to Nevada, to Las Vegas, Nevada. And they were going to have them arrested on American soil in Las Vegas, and they were going to take them away and prosecute them and then squeeze them for all they were worth in order to find out. Yeah, what happened is that was blown by Mr. Ed Meese. Ed Meese got on the phone to the DEA and pressured them to call off that arrest because this would have scotched a very important side negotiation to the NAFTA agreement, which was finished a few years later. So the interesting thing, NAFTA threw, was necessary to do something about putting the kibosh on this investigation that would have decapitated a very critical part of the Mexican ruling elite at a time when they were trying to work out this initial framework for hemispheric consolidation that they're working on. But he, Michael Levine, after he got set up and shot in the chest and then retired, became a very outspoken and very passionate critic of the whole war on drugs. I mean, he's somebody who has got no interest at all in narcotics. His brother Joey was a heroin addict who killed himself because he couldn't live with his addiction any longer. That's why Mike Levine went into the war on drugs with such passion and such fervor. And then he ended up writing a series of books, Deep Cover, The Big White Lie, and then Triangle of Death. Triangle of Death is the one I'm thinking of right now because it talks about the scenario you're describing just a few minutes ago, Jeff, how in order to deal with the ubiquity of the problems associated with narcotics, the American public would be willing to accept severe impositions on their freedom, severe cutbacks on their protections under the Bill of Rights, and that's what's going on right now. He actually had a conversation with a CIA operative in Buenos Aires in 1982, where the guy outlined the whole program for him, and that conversation ended up being put in this book, Triangle of Death, which was a work of fictionalized fact, a sort of a speculative work describing how this is going to be carried out.
Wow.
Here's another book that sort of underscores what you're talking about. I don't know if you're familiar with a guy by the name of Guy Odom. He's a magnificent writer, and I don't particularly like his political ideas, but I have to give him props as a writer. He's a tremendously gifted writer.
Wow.
A book called America's Man on Horseback. If you can find it, I'd recommend reading it. Because he's talking about exactly, once again, what you're describing. Somebody to come after Obama, who would be tasked to clean up the mess that was made under 4 years, if we're fortunate, or 8 years, if we're not, of cultural Marxist rule in this country. Somebody like a General McChrystal, for instance, might be the guy who'd come to power.
Right.
And then create this seamless, fully integrated, top-down, dirigist, American-style fascist regime that would be fully empowered to inflict summary
vengeance.
Yeah, exactly. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
That sort of thing cubed, actually. But America's Man on Horseback is the book. It came out about 10 or 12 years ago. And he's a very bright, very perceptive scholar. I think he's an autodidact. I think he's entirely self-taught. He spent a lot of time in the military, spent a lot of time in high finance. But I don't agree with a lot of what he says, obviously. As somebody who's an individualist, I really can't get behind this kind of coercive collectivist nationalism.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that he really wants to see this happen. I think he sees this as happening whether or not he would prefer that we go another direction. But it's a perfectly terrifying book. I wrote last fall, probably around November, called All the Reich Moves, R-E-I-C-H, All the Reich Moves. If you go to ProLibertalk.blog or LouRockwell.com, there's a section in there where I quote extensively from this book, America's Man on Horseback. But, Jeff, I think you're right. I think there's going to be a backlash, a very severe – it's already going on right now. The backlash that's going on that's going to take us in the wrong direction. It's not going to take us in the direction of decentralization and constitutional restraints on power.
Exactly.
It's going to be a question of, okay, we want the power. We're going to use the powers that this guy's been exercising to set it right when he set it wrong. And chances are we'll end up with a bigger and more lethal dose of the current affliction.
Exactly. Well, I'll put you this way here. I'll try to wrap it up. Another thing too is this dictator will say, "Okay, I'm going to solve the problem on illegal immigration. Every man, woman, and child will be microchipped. We're going to fight the war on Islam. We're going to drop two nukes in Mecca and Medina. We know who they are. Every mosque will be closed. Every church will be monitored. Every extreme Jewish group will be monitored. We're going to pull everything out." Israel will go to the Arabs. Heck with them. We're going to have a Fourth Reich in this country. We need to reduce the population. In other words, it will be Hitler cubed. And you know who's going to get the brunt in this country? Jews and born again Christians. That's who's going to get the brunt, along with libertarians, patriots, and so forth. But you know what? It'll be the Christians who will vote this guy in because he'll sound so good. He will he will say, I'm going to clean the cockroach problem and provide you with food and safe streets. Hitler said he was going to provide safe streets. I thank you for having me on the broadcast, and do have a good one.
Well, God bless you, Jeff. I really appreciate hearing from you, although what you describe is perfectly horrifying and altogether plausible. Once again, if you get a chance, and this is something that I'd recommend to anybody in our audience, if you get a chance to read this book, America's Man on Horseback by Guy Odom, O-D-O-M, I think that it would reward the effort, and it'd be a very pleasant effort, quite frankly, to read it, because he's a very sprightly and colorful writer. He has a way of entertaining, even as he horrifies, and that's an ironic combination of gifts. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call number. Stand by for more Sedition after this. We will not recognize it as it rises. It will wear no black shirts here. It will probably have no marching songs. It will rise out of a congealing of a group of elements that exist here and are the essential components of fascism. It will be at first decorous, humane, glowing with homely American sentiment. But a dictatorship cannot remain benevolent. To continue, it must become ruthless. When this stage is reached, we shall see that appeal by radio, movies, and government-controlled newspapers to all the worst instincts and emotions of our people. The rough, the violent, the lawless men will come to the surface and into power. This is the terrifying prospect as we move along our present course. Those words were written by John T. Flynn of blessed memory, wonderful man, brave and stalwart defender of the Constitution, one of the founders of the America First movement. He was a lawyer, but not otherwise sinister. He was somebody who had been involved in the progressive movement out of a commendable desire, I think, to make institutions accountable and to reduce them to a more human scale. He had supported FDR in the 1932 election, because FDR's platform, some of you might recall, was a small government platform rooted in sound money and constitutional law. And of course, it was a tissue of perverted dishonesty, because it represented the photographic negative of what FDR intended to do. John Nance Garner, his vice presidential candidate, was actually a pretty good guy. He referred to Hoover's intervention in the economy. Don't get the idea, and don't fall for the trick, of course, that's played on us frequently by the left, of treating Hoover as if he were somebody who believed in restraint in terms of the exercise of government power, or some kind of chaste abstinence on the part of government from intervening in the economy. Hoover intervened promiscuously in the American economy. He did everything he could to prevent liquidations from taking place that might have saved the economy. He was doing what FDR did, but not quite as energetically. Nonetheless, John Nance Gardner, FDR's vice presidential candidate, accused Hoover of promoting socialism, which of course he did. And once FDR was inaugurated in March of 1933, they had inaugurals in March rather than January in that period, he immediately pivoted on a dime and began doing exactly what John T. Flynn describes here in this essay that was published in the February 1941 issue of the wonderful and much lamented journal American Mercury. John T. Flynn originally supported FDR, but became mortified by the fact that FDR was doing exactly those things that Hoover had done with a more authoritarian zeal than Hoover had displayed. As a matter of fact, one of the first things that the FDR's brain trust did after they came to power was to consult the writings of Giovanni Gentili and the other architects of the corporatist state in fascist Italy in search of a template for a similar type of government here in the United States. Now, it's not well known, not widely understood, that FDR actually went back to the fons et origo, to the fountain and source of what we now call fascism, which was a 1912 book, an odd little novel called Philip Drew Administrator, that was written by Colonel, so-called Colonel, Edward Mandel House. There was a very historically potent and significant bromance, if you will, between Colonel House. The title was completely bogus. He was a colonel in the same sense that Colonel Sanders was. But there was a bromance between House and Woodrow Wilson. Wilson referred to House as his second self. Philip Drew Administrator was the blueprint for the Woodrow Wilson administration. And it envisioned a fusion of large, politically controlled corporations and a completely unaccountable, executive-dominated socialist government. I think it was Westbrook Pegler who in the 1940s, late 40s, early 50s, correctly pointed out that Philip Drew Administrator was really the first draft of what we would now call fascism. Well, Colonel House actually had a correspondence with FDR. Between FDR's electoral victory in 1932 and his inauguration in March of 1933. And so he actually went back to the source documents on fascism as he was installing a fascist-style government here in the United States. And that was the development that John T. Flynn lamented in that quote from the American Mercury essay of February 1941. Now, John T. Flynn, by this point, had already become an outspoken critic of FDR. He had written a book called Country Squire in the White House. That became the Roosevelt myth, wonderful book, infuriating. And FDR had retaliated by using his influence, which of course was substantial, to get John T. Flynn fired from the New Republic magazine and also to have him blacklisted within the industry. Yes, he was purged on the orders of the dear leader in the White House. That didn't stop John T. Flynn from writing and publishing in 1944 an immensely useful and eternally timely book entitled As We Go Marching. As We Go Marching was an analysis of the question of fascism from the perspective of what fascists do. How do they accumulate power? How do they consolidate their control over countries? This was written, of course, at a time when the United States itself was a fascist country in every particular. It was a wartime economic and political dictatorship. You had a president who was essentially president for life. FDR died in the White House. He defrauded the electorate in the 1944 campaign by concealing the severity of his health situation. And if it hadn't been for the fact that he, for reasons of political convenience, had replaced his second vice president with a truculent little haberdasher from Independence, Missouri, when FDR died and took the handicapped access ramp to hell in 1945, the United States government would have been controlled by Henry Wallace. Mr. Wallace was a communist, an occultist, a disciple of Nicholas Rorick, who was a Russian mystic. As a matter of fact, that's something that John T. Flynn had talked about in his book, The Roosevelt Myth, about the revelation of the Dear Guru letters that had been written by Henry Wallace to Rorick during the 1930s. But Henry Wallace was a Moscow line, overt Moscow line communist of the sort, of course, that very well represented in the FDR regime. But this is a country that had a centrally planned and controlled economy. It had an executive that was all-powerful. It had active conscription for the military. It was involved in warfare overseas. That pretty much was heaven as far as the progressives were concerned. Wartime America was the ideal arrangement. As a matter of fact, if you talk to British laborites, leftists of a certain vintage, and there are a few of them still around, you ask them what their ideal society would be, they'd say, ah, wartime Britain, it was a lovely place. You know, they're nostalgic for a situation that represents crisis and bloodshed and, most importantly, plenary power exercised by government. But while this was the prevailing set of circumstances in America, John T. Flynn wrote this book, As We Go Marching, and his purpose was to disabuse people of the idea that fascism was an Italian or a German or, for that matter, a Japanese affliction. He said, we're up to our necks in it here in the United States. In Italy, you had a welfare state metastasize into a warfare state commanded by an unaccountable executive who created an economy based on a union of politically controlled corporations and a government with unlimited power. You had the same situation prevail in Germany to bring the National Socialists to power, and you had the same thing happening in the United States. And of course, that's what we have today. Mr. Obama is a cultural Marxist in the sense that his roots as an activist, as he admitted in a radio interview back in 2001, his roots are in the idea of what he calls redistributive justice. In other words, using the government to take from some and give to others on the basis of an abstract ideal of equality, making the government the steward of all the wealth of a society and giving it full powers to confer largesse on those it deems worthy on the basis of its utterly whimsical and arbitrary standards, or no standards at all. But the government he presides over is corporatist. I mean, he's as much a tool of the Wall Street oligarchy as his predecessor was. And what's happening now is that in real time we're seeing the consummation of a number of trends that have been sort of latent in our political system. You can say that they started no later than Lincoln, but they're now reaching the full malignancy of their flowering, and in our lifetime we're likely to see some terrible things happen, the likes of which I'll discuss on the other side of this break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397, and we'll be back in just a minute. So here are some of the fundamental traits of an American variant of fascism, which is what John T. Flynn was warning about 7 decades ago in this essay that he wrote for the American Mercury magazine. A fusion of institutions the constitutional framers intended to keep separate, including the abolition or nullification of any residual checks on the power of the central government. You can make a little checklist here to keep track of our progress in the direction of what John T. Flynn was warning about. Back in January, Mr. Obama issued an executive order. And by the way, the promiscuous use of executive orders is one of the traits I would associate with fascism, which is to say a strong executive who presumes to act as a supreme legislator as well. But on January 11th, Mr. Obama issued an executive order creating a council of governors to help, and this is his word, synchronize foreign and domestic military operations. It's not merely another layer, another redundant layer of bureaucracy. It represents the process of consolidation that the founders sought to avoid, or at least to impede, to obstruct, to delay, to forestall. One of the things the founders really wanted to avoid was a unitary government. You can find that word scattered throughout the Federalist Papers, and of course in the Anti-Federalist writings as well. Unitary, monolithic. How often do we hear the idea expressed that the government has to get everybody behind it? We have to have unity and how gridlock is a bad thing. My friends, if you pray for anything, pray for gridlock. Gridlock, of course, is the epithet that corresponds to the constitutional principle of checks and balances. This Council of Governors, which is now in operation, be a bipartisan panel of 10 state governors who meet at the call of various executive functionaries, not the president, but functionaries who are subordinate to him. And that list would include the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security. This Council of Governors would be given the responsibility of the synchronization and integration of state and federal military activities in the United States, with a special emphasis on the role of the National Guard. the National Guard is no longer what it once was. And this is, once again, something that the progressives arranged between, roughly 1890 and World War I. There was a really dramatic change in what the National Guard was all about. And now we have what's best described as a select militia. That's something that we were not supposed to have. The National Guard, of course, was supposed to be the state militia. And no longer is the state militia. I'm not going to get into the details. And quite frankly, there are people who know a lot more about this subject than I do. Suffice it for the purpose of this discussion to say that the National Guard is rapidly becoming a homeland army under the direction of the president working through this Council of Governors. The thing that I find most interesting here is the use of the term synchronized. Now, if you want to translate that to German, and it sometimes helps, in order to clarify what we're talking about, synchronization is a word that can be rendered Gleichschaltung. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I don't know a whole lot of German. I can recognize the odd word here and there. Gleichschaltung was the process of coordination or synchronization, meaning all government functions were consolidated in the office of the chief executive, the chancellor, and through the party, they were all carried out as part of a unitary, unified effort centered in the supreme leader. And that's essentially what we're talking about here with respect to the conduct of the National Guard, which is becoming more and more directly involved in law enforcement. Just in the last week, there have been these stories that have been widely reported, beginning with Fox News in New York, about the fact that the National Guard in New York State, as part of the counter-narcotics strategy, is actively involved in arresting thousands of people a year. Now, there, of course, is a statute called the Posse Comitatus Act that supposedly doesn't permit this. But the Posse Comitatus Act has been perforated with so many exceptions, beginning under the reign of Ronald Reagan, interestingly enough. Ronald Reagan, who's Vice President George W. Bush, was a former head of the CIA, meaning he would have been the former head of the Worldwide Narcotics Syndicate. But it was under Ronald Reagan that you started to see these exceptions to Posse Comitatus being carved out to permit the use of the military in counter-narcotics operations. And now you have the National Guard in the state of New York openly and unabashedly saying that this is a war. Their commanding, not the commanding general, but the commanding colonel, their functional operational commander said this is a war that we're carrying out. Well, it involves the arrest of thousands of people every year, and that, of course, is utterly impermissible under the Posse Comitatus statute. But that's very much typical of what's going on with the National Guard. This is another example. We are seeing the entire conservative movement, almost without exception, embrace the idea that we need to have the National Guard stationed along the border with Mexico in order to deal with what we are told is an implacable invasion in terms of illegal immigration and what we're supposed to believe is the same thing, narcotics smuggling and narco-terrorism. As a matter of fact, the immigration problem, which is substantial, I do not mean to minimize it, is one that is abating, and it has been for several years. That's sort of the upside of the downturn, if you will. And this is true in Arizona, where most of the attention is focused right now. Immigration rates have been consistently falling for about 4 years in Arizona. Violent crime has been falling for 10 years. Yet we're hearing people talk about the supposed need to militarize the border with Mexico, and they're referring to this as a surge. Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona, has what she calls a border surge proposal. She wants to see 6,000 troops stationed on the border with Mexico, 6,000 National Guard troops. And that's part of the militarization of domestic law enforcement that is one of the symptoms of an American style of fascism. Here's another symptom: imposition of the leader principle, under which the powers of the chief executive are self-defined, self-ratifying, and effectively limitless. If you go back and read the organization book of the German National Socialist Party, they make it very clear that the Führer's will is the supreme law of the land. If you go back and read the writings of John Yoo and some of the other apologists for unlimited executive warfare powers, you see the same assumption being followed. and the Obama administration has embraced that as well. Here's another characteristic. Repudiation of explicit and indispensable due process guarantees and protections in the interest of efficiency, expediency, and public safety. I don't know if I need to elaborate on that beyond saying that it's become quite obvious, as one of our callers pointed out, that this is the mindset of government enforcement agencies today, that efficiency and public safety trump the guarantees of individual rights. Take a look at what's going on with British Petroleum liaising with various law enforcement agencies, both state and federal, and shutting down access to the media in the context of that emergency in the Gulf. You actually have a really good example there of what I'm talking about, in the sense that British Petroleum, which is a government venture, actually it's a binational government venture in some significant ways, subsidized and supported by the American government, partially owned by the British government, and they are liaising through the administration, through the Obama administration, and through the Homeland Security Department with various government law enforcement agencies to create a functioning police state in the supposed interest of dealing with this emergency. Completely unaccountable. Their dealings, their doings are opaque. They're, of course, very consequential. It's difficult to exaggerate the potential for human and environmental disaster that this episode represents. And given the time for disaster, there has to be a concomitant commitment to transparency and accountability here. And rather than doing that, of course, we've got exactly the reverse. Well, that's one application of what I'm talking about here. Here's another very important trait. Subsummation of state and local police into a centralized, militarized internal security apparatus. There are too many examples of this going on for me to recite at this juncture. Suffice it to say, this is very commonplace. The emergence of the military as the core public institution. If and when the current Republican conservative movement is thrust back into power, look for this to be the issue that will do it for them and the issue around which they will rally, the idea of the military as the core public institution. Then, of course, we have the appearance of the proverbial man on horseback. And a couple of segments ago, I referred to this book, America's Man on Horseback by Guy Odom. If you can find it, I'd suggest you read it, because it may foretell our future, and I don't think that's a very pleasant prospect. And thus ends Hour 2 of Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in a few minutes with Hour 3. Our call number, 866-986-6397, is available. We'd love to hear from you. So stick around and join us again in a couple minutes, won't you? We'll be right back.